You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Something that I can never reconcile. That is the impact on them. An impact that will echo through their lives. My twins, now 4.5 years old, are far too familiar with death at such a young age. Our once strong and joyful family bonds have been bruised and broken. I have always been so grateful I married into a big, loud, close-knit family. From day one, I was Aunt Kelsey. Tammy was truly my sister, and I cherish the relationships I built with each of her children, my nieces and nephews. However, the relationships with our nieces and nephews, once filled with love and laughter, are now incredibly strained and painful. My children do not know their cousins. The joy of family gatherings, Sunday dinners at grandma's, running around the neighborhood with their cousins, all the things that made our family vibrant and united are now lost. I cannot overstate the closeness, the bonds, the depth of relationships that have been shattered. My children and Tammy's grandchildren are growing up missing out on the essential family connections that brought so much richness to Tammy's own children's lives. I desperately hope these relationships can be repaired. The toll has been profound. My mother-in-law passed away last year, and the strain from Tammy's death and the severed relationships with her grandchildren took a monumental toll on her health. She passed without fully repairing these relationships, a reality that I cannot accept. Reflecting on these past 4.5 years, every joyful moment is overshadowed. Memories are tarnished, especially those of my children's early years. We've sought counseling. We've leaned on our family for support to navigate through trauma and grief, but we are exhausted beyond measure. Tammy's murder is the direct cause of our suffering. Pain, fractured relationships, and unhealed wounds are all part of the aftermath. This is the legacy of anguish and sorrow that will haunt our family for generations. Thank you.
All right. If the state has another victim to have an impact statement offered, we can do that at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state would call Ben Douglas.
You can proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Douglas, can you state your name and spell it for the record?
Benjamin Douglas, B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N, Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S.
And can you tell the jury which victim in this case you're related to and how?
I am Tammy Daybell's youngest brother.
Thank you. Did you prepare a statement to read today?
Yes, I have one.
If you could do that now, thank you.
October 10th, 2019, I became a father of twins after years of my wife, Kelsey, and I struggling to have children. We started the current chapter of our life. Just 9 days later, on Saturday, October 19th, 2019, exhausted as a parent to newborn twins is, I received a phone call from my sister Samantha informing me that our sister Tammy had passed away overnight. I was in shock and physically unable to move out of that bed for hours after, sobbing and wondering why this had. I had seen her just a few weeks previous when she stopped by our home alongside my parents, bringing gifts for the twins, and excitedly saying that she was had been hoping they'd show up in time for her visit. My children only know their Aunt Tammy from pictures, stories, and grave marker that they frequently request to visit. They only know their dad as someone dealing with great amounts of grief and anxiety, and I only know how to parent as someone fighting through the tidal waves of loss, media coverage, texts, phone calls, and at-home visits from reporters. The amount of sleepless nights I've had from raising twins pales in comparison to the nights I've been kept awake by nightmares of someone close to me hurting my children. The amount of damage, having trust that was built over decades of family time, completely broken, does to an individual is unmeasurable. The pain of not just losing your sibling, But to have their children, my nieces and nephews, completely alter their relationships with me is excruciating and a lasting hurt. Instead of there being a collective healing and grieving process, there is still ongoing damage and pain. Where there should be love and comfort from close family bonds, there are now major fractures that I can only hope will one day mend and be made whole. I miss sharing our birthday month, which now feels hollow and empty. I miss my sister. Thank you.
All right. If the state would like to call another victim to make an impact statement, you may do so.
Honor, could we approach?
Yes. All right. Thank you, counsel. We've been going some time at this point. In lieu of lunch, however, we do just want to take a restroom break because I'm not sure that there's too many more. However, I think it is a good time to stop and give everyone a break for a moment. So we'll take about a 15-minute recess and come back on for additional victim impact statements.
All right, please. All right.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, the jurors are lined up, so we'll go ahead and remain standing, please, if we can have the jurors return to the courtroom.
All right. Please offer President Tanner for your honor.
Thank you. Please be seated. Okay, we're back on the record on KCR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. I appreciate everyone's patience as we work through this process today. There's a lot of administrative matters being taken up while we're not on the bench, but we're moving things along at this time. I'll note the jurors have returned and are properly seated. And we are continuing with victim impact statements, and I believe the state has a few more victim impact statements this afternoon. So who's going to be calling the next victim up to the stand?
I will, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Beatty, you can call the next person to give a statement.
Your Honor, the next individual would be Colby Ryan.
Okay.
Colby, could you state your full name and spell your last name?
Colby Ryan, R-Y-A-N.
Are you here to talk about Tylee and JJ today?
Yes.
How are you related to Tylee and JJ?
Tylee is my little sister and JJ is my little brother.
Did you prepare a statement to read today?
Yes.
Would you like to read that now?
Yes.
Go ahead.
It is very hard for me to put into words what it means to have lost my entire family. I lost the ability to watch Tylee and JJ grow up. I lost my relationship with my little brother, which took years to build.
It's okay if you need a moment. Take a moment if you need to. It's all right.
It took years to build to even have him be able to look us in the eyes. I lost the ability, to sit with my little sister and talk and share our lives. So in short, I lost everything I've ever known. I lost the ability to share my children with them or have my children have the privilege to know them and be loved by them. My three kids will never know the kindness of Tylee's heart or JJ's silly and goofy personality. But more importantly, Tylee and JJ lost their lives. Tylee will never be able to travel like she always wanted to or have a family of her own or find herself in this world. JJ will never be able to spread his love or his light around the world the way he used to. The only way I could describe the impact of their lives being lost is like a nuclear bomb dropping. Tylee will never be able to share her gifts with the world or have all the people who love her get to hear her incredible laugh. Sorry. JJ will never get to grow up and share his one-of-a-kind personality with the world, and everyone who's lost him feels the void. It's not an overstatement to say that I lost everything, but more importantly, we all lost Tylee and JJ. I stand here today, motherless, fatherless, sisterless, and brotherless. The only course forward is to trust in Christ, knowing that he has them in his arms, and wait for the day that we all meet again. I pray for all of you who have bleeding hearts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the state would next call Samantha Gawilliam.
Very well. Go ahead, Mr. Wixom.
Thank you. Ma'am, will you please state and spell your name for the record?
Samantha Gwilliam, G-W-I-L-L-I-A-M.
And could you remind the jury how you're related to the victims?
Tammy is my sister.
Thank you. And do you have a prepared statement?
I do.
Would you like to go ahead and read that now?
I would like to. I speak out for my sister, Tammy Daybell, because she cannot speak for herself. She is dead, and others who were supposed to stand up for her, protect her, and love her did not. From the moment I found out that she was gone, I have never felt peace. In the first few weeks, I had a gut feeling that something wasn't right and that someone had done something to her, but I didn't know why. So many questions come up as a quick funeral is arranged, no autopsy and no answers. As we find out about a quick marriage, I smell a rat. As any woman does, I search out answers and dig through whatever evidence I can find. None of it was reassuring or good. There's still no peace to be found. We are questioned by police about missing children, and this uneasiness I had felt about Tammy's death only intensifies. We are notified that Tammy has been exhumed, and this is my first moment of maybe now I can get the answers I seek. But with the pandemic and exhaustive testing, I don't see results for a long time. My family sits in a limbo of not knowing why or what happened. In the meantime, there is a large investigation, many more questions. We are hounded by news reporters through phone calls, texts, emails, social media, and even with surprise visits at our front door. Still no peace. I am asked about a pet cemetery. And a few days later, I watch with the world as the bodies of two precious missing children are found on the same property where my sister died. I wretched and sobbed over learning about JJ and Tylee. Two more victims, and no peace to be found for anyone. When we finally get the long-awaited autopsy results, our worst fears are confirmed, and we know that she was murdered. We have spent almost 5 years waiting for there to be peace. My sister, Tammy, was my best friend. Before she moved to Idaho, we talked to each other almost every day, or saw each other almost every day. Her first year there was a hard adjustment, but she made a place for herself there and was a great member of her community. Tammy was a force for good at her school, influencing children, making friendship with others, and being a person you could count on, part of me. She loved being a mom, and especially a grandma. She was so excited to be part of their lives. She was content and happy. Her and I had made plans that when we were old that we would live next door to each other. We helped raise each other's children. We were excited for the future. My last visit I had with Tammy is the last time I have felt any peace. I would not be a good sister if I did not defend Tammy as well. She was made out by some in this court as if she was lazy and fat and dying from an illness. Look at me right now. I am the same age as Tammy was when she died. She was in better health than I am right now. Do I look like I am dying? It is not a crime to be a middle-aged woman trying to be healthy and still play a video game or eat fast food occasionally. My sister was ripped from our lives. Because of her murder, we lost a beloved mother, grandmother, sister, aunt, and daughter. She is irreplaceable. She started with one grandchild and missed seeing the next five that would be born. They will never get to know her. But when Tammy died, that is not the only thing that we lost. Her absence created a void that is unmistakable. We used to have a close relationship with Tammy's children, but now our relationship is strained, and some of the kids that I helped raise no longer speak to us. My mother passed away last June. She had to spend the last of her years separated from these same grandchildren for no fault of her own. My mother declined in health while still not having peace. Her passing was marred by the fact that Tammy's children chose to not participate in her funeral. The lies, deception, and murder have ripped our family apart. We do not feel peace. I am not a dark person or a zombie, and for me and my family to be betrayed this way is unacceptable. I am tired of being vilified, so there is a reason to not listen to me. I stand for truth, and I don't lie. So know as I say this now, my sister should not be dead right now. She should be here alive and smiling with her family and friends. She should be doting on her grandchildren, and taking care of her animals. It is a cruel world that has taken her from us. We need to feel some peace for the first time in 5 years. I miss my sister every day. I will grieve for her for the rest of my life. I speak up for her now because she needs a voice. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Very well, does the state have another victim to make an impact statement?
Yes, Your Honor. The state will call Michael Douglas.
Okay. You can inquire, Ms. Blake.
Thank you. Would you please state your name for the record?
Michael Douglas.
And are you related to a victim in this matter?
I am.
And who is that?
Tammy.
How are you related to Tammy?
I am Tammy's sibling.
Did you prepare a statement for today?
I did.
Would you please read that?
I will. I am Tammy's older brother and the oldest of the Douglas siblings. My experience and the impact this has had on me has been profound. The day Tammy was killed, I received a phone call, and I looked down to see Samantha's name. I answered the phone. Good morning, Samantha said. It's not going to be. It turns out she was right. I was in shock, and after the funeral, I drove to Idaho the next morning to be at her Idaho memorial. When I left, I called my wife and told her something was off. I tried to keep everyone from jumping to conclusions, mostly myself. I probably should have done more jumping. When we heard about the marriage, we were given a false date to lead us to believe that it had not been only 2 weeks. Then we found out the real date. I'd received a call from my Aunt Vicky and my cousin Julie, encouraging me to pursue an autopsy. I told them I couldn't because I was doing everything I could to keep my mom and dad alive. When we found out about the exhumation, I hoped that there was nothing to be found and never wanted someone to be more wrong than I wanted Aunt Vicky to be wrong. But it was me that was wrong again. All of us were devastated by the exhumation, but especially my mother. She saw the exhumation as a desecration of Tammy's gravesite. Once Tammy was reinterred, my mom asked that we would meet again at the gravesite, and we did so and held a family service. And then received a phone call from my mother indicating that there were two missing children. I remember where I was, what I was doing, and the exact feeling of, oh, please, no. Please don't let this be so. My heart sank, and I said to my mom, Mom, Chad told us they were empty nesters. Surely this is a mistake, not anything to worry about. Maybe they have them in hiding. Maybe there's something else going on. Oh, I was wrong again. People would come up and ask if the kids had been found yet when they would see me in public. And the stress and anxiety grew. And then the day came that the children were found. I broke into more pieces than I can count. I was at work, began crying hysterically, and had to be rushed into an office. I was surrounded by people that had figured out that this was coming long before I did. Hope was lost. I went into therapy, both talk and medicinal. My blood pressure went so high that my doctor prescribed something he'd only done 3 times previous in his long career. He was afraid I was having a stroke right there in the office and had an ambulance on standby in case I did so. When I learned of the results of the autopsy, I did not sleep for 6 weeks. The nightmare fodder that I have been provided will last me a lifetime. My insurance rates have skyrocketed due to the medications I started on right after the children were found, and I'm now ineligible for certain coverages. As the big brother, I felt and I feel like a failure. I failed to protect Tammy. I looked for a silver lining, as we do as big brothers, trying to set up some kind of win, and none to be found. For the first time in my life, I was unable to function at the level I always had. Work, family, God, all of my relationships suffered. I had to be told by my therapist that I had already lost, that I would not find a win. I have mostly come to terms with that, but the loss is still so very raw. I now have an angry part that has become hopefully not a permanent part of me. People that have known me most of my life don't know who I am. They don't know what I'm going through because they are not the big brother whose sister was killed. I cannot tell you what my dad or siblings have suffered because I did not lose a child or an older sibling. The grief and suffering is unique to each of us, but has driven wedges of misunderstanding. If this were radioactivity we were dealing with, I would look to the half-life to see when the pain and suffering might stop. The half-life of this experience will cover generations and many lifetimes. The scarring continues and the painful things keep happening. I have likened it to being in a slow-motion train crash these past 4.5 years. Watching loved ones and myself, as well as total strangers, caught up in the disaster. Continuing to be pummeled with no end in sight. Today, hopefully, that train wreck loses momentum and finally comes to a screeching halt. I helped to found a charity to honor Tammy's legacy and to keep her memory alive. We named it after her, and I have had many suggest that the name Daybell should not be there. That was her name. That was and is her children's names and her grandchildren's names and will continue to be. We have strived to stay out of the public eye, to not do media requests, to not speak publicly about this because we have attempted to continue our relationships with Tammy's children, to be able to have relationships with her grandchildren, all of their families. We love them and care for them, but there has been an alienation that is as painful as losing Tammy. We have relatives, children that have joined the family that we have not been allowed to meet due to this train wreck that you're all part of. I have been robbed of the opportunity of growing old with my little sister, being grandparents together and teasing each other into old age. I have had my peace stolen, and I have to fight every day to be patient and kind with others and myself. I have had some that have seen my wounds and have attempted to exploit this time of anguish for their personal gain. This train wreck has brought out much good in many, but has fostered much evil in others. I have lost a large portion of my income, my creative energy, and my ability to be of service to others due to the general loss of energy and health that this has caused. I am wounded, broken, sad, angry, disgusted, betrayed, and looking for answers on the constant pain of grief and loss. We hope that after this is over, we can attain closure and healing and take the next steps to finding ways to heal and grow stronger from these wounds afflicted upon us. Tammy, JJ, and Tylee have all been robbed of that choice and that chance.
All right. Does the state have any further victim impact statements to provide?
We do not, Your Honor.
All right. At that point, then, with the proceedings, the next inquiry the court would make is in relation to the defendant's right of allocution. Mr. Pryor, have you discussed with Mr. Daybell his right to make an allocution before the jury considers?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is Mr. Daybell going to make any allocution?
No, Your Honor.
Is that correct, Mr. Daybell? No allocution? Very well. That will conclude the submission of evidence and the right of allocution in this proceeding. The next issue the court will take up then is briefly reviewing the final instructions that will be given to the jurors, as well as a verdict form before they retire for deliberation. We do need to take a moment to review those with counsel outside of the presence of the jurors. They are prepared, so I don't think this will be an extensive break, but we will take a break here for the court to go through jury instructions with counsel. Once that's concluded, we'll have the jurors brought back in for any closing arguments that may be presented by the state and the defense. So if all would rise for the jurors, we'll do that at this time. Thank you. Please be seated. Counsel, the court has submitted for your review sentencing phase jury instructions. The court's already read several of the instructions to the jurors, and there are additional instructions. With our apologies, the numbering is out of order, which I'll explain to the jurors just in the manner of which we were putting these together today. But the remaining instructions that have not been read to the jurors would include instruction as labeled number 5, instruction number 9, number 10, 11, 12, 16, and we've got 14 and 15 is the order I'll be reading those in, and a proposed verdict form. So before I give these instructions to the jurors, I do want to have counsel an opportunity to indicate whether or not on the record there are any objections to the form of instructions. The court would note the Supreme Court just recently approved new criminal jury instructions for this sentencing phase, and the court has incorporated those wherever it was practical to do so, and they were not in conflict with any previous given instructions. So from the state, then, I'm not sure who would address the court here. Is it Ms. Blake?
Yes, Your Honor.
Have you reviewed the court's proposed instructions?
Yes, we have, Your Honor.
Have you also reviewed the verdict form?
Yes, we have.
Do you have any objection to the form in which these are going to be submitted to the jurors?
We have no objection, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Pryor, have you been able to review the proposed instructions in the verdict form?
Yes, Your Honor.
As to the instructions, is there any objection to which these have been drafted by the court?
Judge, this has been objected, and I'm just going to make this a verbal objection, and that's going to be that the court applied the standard of reasonable doubt that you chose to apply based on a previous instruction to the jury before the Supreme Court came out with these decisions. However, the Supreme Court has noted that the instructions are to be applied immediately. I'm making this a verbal objection to preserve the record that the firmly convinced language of reasonable doubt is what I anticipated and expected to be included in not only the original instructions to the jury, but now the sentencing instructions. And I'll just make that a verbal objection.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pryor. Are there any other objections on the form of instructions or on the verdict form?
Nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Mr. Pryor, I, on that objection, I've considered that previously in the trial for the reason that we had already given the jurors a instruction defining reasonable doubt, and I didn't want to change midstream that definition, whether in this proceeding or in the course of the trial. I've stuck with the instruction that's been used in Idaho for a long time. I have considered your objection. I am going to overrule that objection, and so the instructions that the court's proposed now are going to be provided. We'll give the jurors courtesy copies. There will be one original copy for them to take with them, as well as an original verdict form. We're going to get those jury instructions distributed at this time just on the juror seats. They'll be able to read along, and then I'll read through final instructions. And then if the parties have closings, you can take those up next. All right. If those have been distributed, then we can have the jurors brought back in, please. Thank you.
All right, please. Here's our present count for you.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'll note on the record the jurors have returned and we are on the record. At this point, the court is going to read your instructions for this special sentencing proceeding. I've already read certain instructions, and those will be included in your copies there. I will note that the numbers are generally out of order on these. Don't concern yourself with the ordering or if there are any gaps in numbers. These are the instructions you're to have in the way they are ordered by number. I'll also note that they will have an original set of instructions for you in your deliberations. Please don't write on those or mark them up in any way, but you may make any notes if you wish on the copies you've been provided. So the instruction towards the middle of that packet I'm going to be starting with, where I haven't already read through, is labeled instruction number 5. And that's somewhat in the middle, following what I already read on instruction number 7. So instruction number 5 is as follows. You have now heard all the evidence in the case. My duty is to instruct you as to the law. You must follow all the rules as I explain them to you. You may not follow some and ignore others. Even if you disagree or don't understand the reasons for some of the rules, you are bound to follow them. If anyone states a rule of law different from any I tell you, it is my instruction that you must follow. No single instruction describes all the law that must be applied. You must consider the instructions together as a whole. In considering whether a sentence of death is justified, you shall not consider the race, color, religious beliefs, national origin, gender, or sexual orientation of the defendant or of any victim. You are not to impose a death sentence unless you conclude that you would do so no matter what the race, color, religious beliefs, national origin, gender, or sexual orientation of the defendant or victims may be. I have not meant by these instructions or by any ruling or remark I have made to indicate any opinion as to the facts of what your verdict should be. Instruction number 9. You have been instructed that the state has alleged the statutory aggravating circumstance that the murder was committed for remuneration or the promise of remuneration, or the defendant employed another to commit the murder for remuneration or the promise of remuneration. In order to find the defendant guilty of the statutory aggravating circumstance, you must unanimously find, beyond a reasonable doubt, remuneration was a motive, reason, or impetus for the murder and not merely the result of the murder. Remuneration means payment or compensation. Instruction number 10. You have been instructed that the state has alleged the statutory aggravating circumstance that the murder was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. In order to find the defendant guilty of this statutory aggravating circumstance, you must unanimously find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the murder was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. The terms especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel are considered separately, but in combination with manifesting exceptional depravity. The terms heinous, atrocious, or cruel are intended to refer to those first-degree murders where the actual commission of the first-degree murder was accomplished by such additional acts as to set the crime apart from the norm of first-degree murders. A murder is heinous if it is extremely wicked or shockingly evil. Atrocious means outrageously wicked and vile. Cruel means designed to inflict a high degree of pain with utter indifference to or even enjoyment of the suffering of others. This statutory aggravating circumstance does not exist unless the murder was especially heinous, especially atrocious, or especially cruel, and such heinousness, atrociousness, or cruelty manifested exceptional depravity. It might be thought that every murder involves depravity. However, exceptional depravity exists only where depravity is apparent to such an extent as to obviously offend all standards of morality and intelligence. The terms especially heinous, manifesting exceptional depravity, especially atrocious, manifesting exceptional depravity, or especially cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity, focus upon a defendant's state of mind at the time of the offense as reflected by his words and acts. Instruction number 11. You have been instructed that the state has alleged the statutory aggravating circumstance that the murder or circumstances surrounding its commission, the defendant exhibited utter disregard for human life. In order to find the defendant guilty of this statutory aggravating circumstance, you must unanimously find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that by the murder or circumstances surrounding its commission, the defendant exhibited utter disregard for human life. Exhibited utter disregard for human life with regard to the murder or the circumstances surrounding its commission refers to acts or circumstances surrounding the crime that exhibit the highest, the utmost callous disregard for human life, i.e., the cold-blooded, pitiless slayer. Cold-blooded means marked by absence of warm feeling, without consideration, compunction, or clemency, matter of fact, or emotionless. Pitiless means devoid of or unmoved by mercy or compassion. A cold-blooded, pitiless slayer refers to a slayer who kills without feeling or sympathy. The utter disregard factor refers to the defendant's lack of conscience regarding killing another human being. Instruction number 12. You have been instructed that the state has alleged the statutory aggravating circumstance that the defendant, by his conduct, whether such conduct was before, during, or after the commission of the murder at hand, has exhibited a propensity to commit murder, which will probably constitute a continuing threat to society. In order to find the defendant guilty of this statutory aggravating circumstance, you must unanimously find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant, by his conduct, whether such conduct was before, during, or after the commission of the murder at hand, has exhibited a propensity to commit murder, which will probably constitute a continuing threat to society. The phrase exhibited a propensity to commit murder, which will probably constitute a continuing threat to society, means conduct showing that the defendant is more likely than not to be a continuing threat to society. You may consider conduct that occurred before, during, or after the commission of the murder you have already found the defendant guilty of in this case. However, a finding that the defendant has a propensity to commit murder, which will probably constitute a continuing threat to society, cannot be based solely upon the fact that you found the defendant guilty of murder. In order for a person to have a propensity to commit murder, the person must be a willing, predisposed killer, a killer who tends toward destroying the life of another, one who kills with less than the normal amount of provocation. Propensity requires a proclivity, a susceptibility, and even an affinity toward committing the act of murder. Instruction number 16, the state has alleged more than one statutory aggravating circumstance in this case. You must consider whether the state has proven the existence of more than one statutory aggravating circumstance beyond a reasonable doubt by relying on the same facts or independent facts. The same facts, without more, cannot be relied on to find more than one statutory aggravating circumstance beyond a reasonable doubt. Independent facts must exist for each statutory aggravating circumstance in order for you to find that the state has proven multiple statutory aggravating circumstances beyond a reasonable doubt. Instruction number 14. I have outlined for you the rules of law applicable to this case and have told you of some of the matters which you may consider in weighing the evidence. In a few minutes, counsel will present their closing remarks to you, and then you will retire to the jury room for your deliberations. The arguments and statements of the attorneys are not evidence. If you remember the facts differently from the way the attorneys have stated them, you should base your decision on what you remember. The attitude and conduct of jurors at the beginning of your deliberations are important. It is rarely productive at the outset for you to make an emphatic expression of your opinion on the case or state how you intend to vote. When you do that at the beginning, your sense of pride may be aroused and you may hesitate to change your position. Remember that you are not partisans or advocates, but you are judges. As jurors, you have a duty to consult with one another and to deliberate before making your individual decisions. You may fully and fairly discuss among yourselves all of the evidence you have heard and seen in this courtroom about the case, together with the law that relates to this case as contained in these instructions. During your deliberations, you each have a right to re-examine your own views and change your opinions. You should only do so if you are convinced by fair and honest discussion that your original opinion has changed based upon the evidence and the law as given you in these instructions. Consult with one another, consider each other's views, and deliberate with the objective of reaching an agreement if you can do so without disturbing your individual judgment. Each of you must decide the case for yourself, but you should do so only after a discussion and consideration of the case with your fellow jurors. However, none of you should surrender your honest opinion as to the weight or effect of evidence because the majority of the jury feels otherwise, or for the purpose of returning a verdict. Instruction number 15, in reaching your verdict, you must first decide whether the state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that any of the statutory aggravating circumstances exist. You must consider each of the alleged statutory aggravating circumstances. Your decision that each statutory aggravating circumstance exists must be unanimous. If you find that the state has failed to prove the existence of any statutory aggravating circumstance, or if you are unable to unanimously agree on that issue, then you must so indicate on the verdict form. If the state has failed to prove the existence of any statutory aggravating circumstance, you need not deliberate further. Merely notify the bailiff that you are done. The judge must then sentence the defendant to life in prison, and the judge must set a fixed period of imprisonment of at least 10 years during which the defendant will not be eligible for parole. If you unanimously find that the state has proven the existence of a statutory aggravating circumstance, then you must so indicate on the verdict form. You must also then consider whether any mitigating circumstances exist to make that imposition of the death penalty unjust. If you find that all mitigating circumstances are sufficiently compelling to make the imposition of the death penalty unjust, or you cannot unanimously agree on that issue, then the defendant will be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. A life sentence without possibility of parole under Idaho law means that a person must spend the rest of his or her natural life in prison. If you find that all mitigating circumstances are not sufficiently compelling to make the imposition of the death penalty unjust, then the defendant will be sentenced to death. You must decide for yourself whether all mitigating factors presented when weighed against each statutory aggravating circumstance proven by the state are sufficiently compelling to make the imposition of the death penalty unjust. You do not have to unanimously agree upon what mitigating circumstances exist. The existence of mitigating factors need not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. You must each decide for yourselves whether mitigating circumstances exist, and if so, then consider them in your individual weighing process. Once you have reached a unanimous decision on whether all mitigating circumstances, when weighed against each aggravating circumstance, make the imposition of the death penalty unjust, or if you cannot unanimously agree on that issue, then you must indicate on the verdict form and notify the bailiff that you are done. All right, that concludes the instructions. As I mentioned, there will be a conforming verdict form that will be submitted for the jury foreperson as well. And the jury foreperson is to remain as the same foreperson that had that role during the guilt phase of the trial. So, counsel, at this time, then, that concludes the court's instructions to the jurors. If the state would like to begin with a closing, you may do so at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, if I may have use of the HDMI.
Yes. Ms. Blake, I'll just inquire on the record, but are there going to be any graphic images in this?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, labeling someone dark, lowering their death percentage, marking them for death. What is the appropriate measure of justice? On August 12th of 2019, Lori switched Tylee's Social Security payments to go into her SOL, meaning Lori's SOL, BBVA account. The first payment was deposited on August 28th of 2019. Less than 2 weeks later, Tylee was dead. On September 18th of 2019, Lori received the first payments associated with the Social Security that she and JJ were receiving because of Charles' death. Just 5 days later, JJ Vallow was dead. Lori found out that she was not going to get the $1 million life insurance policy on Charles around July 11th of 2019, and she messaged Chad to let him know that. But remember what she told Chad: I'll still get the $4,000 in Social Security. On September 8th of 2019, Tammy's life insurance was increased. Chad signed off on that application. Tammy was dead just a little over a month later, while the attempted shooting was almost 1 month to the day that she upped her life insurance. Remember the multiple messages relaying the plan is for Chad and Lori to be together, alone on a beach, unencumbered by telestial obstacles, unencumbered by earthly obstacles. Chad formed the plan. That plan included manipulating those around him to ensure that he could end up on a tropical island with Lori Vallow, who eventually became Lori Vallow Daybell. She was a woman that he deemed to have perfect proportions and to be a goddess. But in order to fund a new lifestyle, living on a tropical island and spending all your time with your new goddess lover, how do you fund that lifestyle? And how do you remove the obstacles to getting there? First, Chad taught others that he could determine whether someone was dark and or possessed. Second, he taught others that if someone was possessed or too dark, then the body had to be destroyed or die to free the person. Third, he started teaching those around him that he could determine death percentages. Essentially, this meant that Chad could mark someone for death and determine when it was their time to go. He exhibited that power to those around him. He exhibited that power of his self-proclaimed visions to those who believed him and followed him. When we talk about if the murders were committed for remuneration or financial gain, the defendant received $430,000 in life insurance money after Tammy's death, money that was used to fund his life in Hawaii with Lori. Lori continued to receive the Social Security payments from the kids, kids whose bodies were hidden on Chad's property so that they could continue to receive those Social Security payments. The murder was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, manifesting exceptional depravity. What else could these murders be? Tylee, unknown cause of death, because of her body being burned so severely, there were charred bones, remains in a melted green bucket. JJ, cause of death, asphyxiation by a plastic bag over his head. Not only that, but he had tape over his mouth, a plastic bag over his head, tape around that bag, his arms duct taped from elbow to elbow, and then placed in a black garbage bag. He also had scratches on his neck. And you saw the last known video of JJ. Those scratches don't appear to be there. Tammy, cause of death by asphyxiation, manner, homicide. Tammy killed in her own home, a place where she should have felt safe. Her life extinguished. By the murder, the defendant exhibited utter disregard for human life. Tylee was only 16 years old. JJ, only 7 years old. Tammy, a 49-year-old mother of five. The mother of the defendant's kids. It didn't matter the age of the victim or who relied on them and loved them. If they were in the way of Chad and his plan, and or if there was money to be gained for Lori and Chad, those individuals were marked for death. The defendant, by prior conduct or conduct in the murder at hand, has exhibited a potential to commit murder, which will probably constitute a continuing threat to society. Again, three victims killed, all at different times. Again, the defendant determining who was possessed, determining the death percentages, and once again, the defendant determining when it was their time to go. And Alex Cox believing and trusting Chad 100%. Alex said shortly before his death, "I am worried I am going to be their fall guy." Another statement he made, "Either I am a man of God or I am not." Lori, when asked about believing Chad, "If Chad is a Satan, he sure is a good one." Chad told more people than just Lori and Alex about people being dark. You heard of other people that were labeled as dark by Chad, including 12-year-old kids. The only difference is it was only those that stood in his way of his plan or who there was going to be financial gain from that ended up dead. Ladies and gentlemen, you will decide what justice is. At every stage of the development of the plan that resulted in the death of Tylee and her body being burnt with parts still missing, the death of JJ wrapped in plastic bags and duct tape and discarded in Chad's yard, the death of Tammy Daybell, who had her ability to breathe, to live, suppressed. Tylee was last seen on September 8th of 2019. JJ was last seen on September 22nd of 2019. Then Tammy was discovered deceased in her home October 19th, 2019.
My name is Tammy Daybell.
At any point between these deaths, the defendant could have stopped, but he didn't. He continued to rate people as dark and zombies. He continued to determine death percentages. And he continued to move forward with his plan to ensure that he was on a beach with Lori Vallow, unencumbered by earthly relatives, earthly obstacles. Ladies and gentlemen, we ask you to consider what is just in this case in rendering your decision. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. At this time, the defense may present a closing if you wish, Mr. Pryor.
Question to
yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to go back to the indictment in this case. And the indictment accused Chad Daybell of espousing religious beliefs. And if you go back and look at the indictment, it talks one of the overt acts was espousing the religious beliefs to justify a killing. One of the other overt acts is that they claim that Chad did a south-southwest wind direction. And if you look back at the indictment, you'll see that all of the other overt acts, every one of them dealt with, as far as JJ and Tylee are concerned, dealt with actions by Lori Vallow. When we talk about remuneration, let's go back into a little history lesson. Let's talk about Joseph Ryan. Before Chad ever knew Lori Vallow, the plan was set for Joseph Ryan and Lori to collect the insurance, the life insurance proceeds. The plan was already in place before Chad was ever even in the picture. And then we get the plan with Charles Vallow. And then I know I spoke to you at the time of my closing about Chad Daybell and the insurance for, you know, that Lori was claiming to get on Chad. If you know, you've made your decision, but if you look at the indictment, the allegations with Chad Daybell are not about remuneration or money. The allegations with Chad Daybell were allegedly religious beliefs and espousing religious beliefs. And the time we spent on the screen was about religious beliefs that he claimed to have had and that he espoused. This had nothing to do with money. Nothing to do with money. The insurance on Tammy Daybell, the $300,000, was set in 2002. And the state cannot allege that in 2002, Chad Daybell had some plan to collect insurance. When you look at the documents of the upping in the insurance, Tammy Daybell upped her insurance because it was relatively cheap. But the reason Chad Daybell signed that document, signed off, is because he was also getting $20,000 insurance. And the only reason he had to sign was because, if you listen to what the real estate or the insurance folks said, is if he's getting insurance as well on himself, he has to sign. This has nothing to do with money. You found that there was murders, and I want you to read the statute and the direction and the directions what the judge has presented to you as what you have to find in terms of atrocious conduct. And the judge specifically said there that if you find that there was a murder, that's not enough. You have to go beyond bounds of human decency. And if you look back at this case, if you recall, Chad Daybell was never present for the actual murder of Tylee Ryan. Chad Daybell was never present. There were many other people present for the murder of JJ Vallow. And whether you believe or not that Chad Daybell suffocated Tammy Daybell, and it's as tragic as that is, that doesn't reach the heinous, atrocious conduct that's defined by what the judge is instructing you. And at this point, folks, I'm going to ask you to find that there was no conduct that rose to the level that the state is trying to present at this point. Thank you.
All right, that concludes the closing of the defense. Does the state wish to present any brief rebuttal closing?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Very well. That'll conclude the special sentencing proceeding then. In terms of presentation of evidence and argument, the next matter then is the jurors will again retire to deliberate on these questions posed to them in these proceedings. I am going to, although already sworn again for the special proceeding, I'll have the bailiffs who will be holding the jurors during the deliberations. If you'd please come forward, I'm going to have the clerk administer the oath to you in terms of the deliberation. So, Madam Clerk, if you would please do that at this time.
You solemnly swear or affirm that you will keep this jury together in some quiet and convenient place, that you will not suffer any communication to be made to them, nor make any communication to them yourself on any subject connected with the trial of this case, except to ask if they have agreed upon a verdict, and upon their agreeing upon a verdict, you will return them into open court or upon the order of the court, so help you God.
All right. Thank you, Madam Clerk, and thank you to the bailiffs here. The court will note, of course, that's the original 12 jurors who return the verdict in this case that will further deliberate on this. And for the alternates, we very much appreciate your continued patience while we work through these processes. At this time then, if all will rise, we'll begin deliberations.
All right.
All right, we'll be in recess.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.